just back from my final weekend of classes at the University of Pennsylvania in the Masters of Applied Positive Psychology. It has truly been a life-changing experience. It's been an emotional experience. It's been an experience where I finally feel like I belong somewhere with other people who have a shared mission and vision like I do. And there are no words to describe how important that this has been for me. But not only that, I am so excited to bring forward the things that I have learned to share them with you. I've already begun, and there is so much more to go. I'm now working on my thesis, or about to work on my thesis as I finish up my finals. And it has just been such a journey, and I can't wait to really bring you with me as soon as I'm done. Welcome to another episode of The Sonya Looney Show. It's a big one for many reasons that we'll get into in just a minute. But if you're new around here, this show is about high performance and well-being and how we can play at the intersection. I am a world champion professional athlete. I am finishing up my master's in applied positive psychology. I am a coach, a speaker, and a mom to two toddlers. We are gearing up for some exciting changes around here, and I'm just continually grateful for all of the incredible conversations I've had over the years. In fact, it's been almost 7 years of doing this podcast, which is absolutely phenomenal. And I have learned so much, and I hope that you have too. Don't forget to go back and check out previous episodes. You can go to sonyalooney.com/podcasts. There's a drop-down menu, and you can search based on category that you're interested in listening to, because this is such a wide-ranging podcast. I can't wait to introduce you to today's guest. Daniel Troyo is a fellow cycling enthusiast and documentarian whose journey into bike touring has taken him on remarkable adventures across the globe. We've had other incredible guests who are bike packing enthusiasts like Ryan Van Duzer and many others. And today's guest was particularly exciting to me because he did it without money. He did it without food. He did it as a way to help us remember that we're all good inside. Daniel shares his spirit of curiosity and exploration that fuels his adventures, as well as the personal growth, resilience, and deepened sense of empathy that he has developed through challenging experiences like biking unsupported across the country. Can you imagine sitting outside a convenience store with your bike, begging for food and money as you have the goal of going across the United States on the bike? That is hard to even imagine. And it wasn't only that he went one way. He did it out and back on his bike, unsupported. And he recorded a documentary about this, which you can find in the show notes. The documentary film project allowed him to process this 7-month bike tour through storytelling and gave him a new appreciation for the kindness of strangers. There is so much in this podcast episode that I cannot wait for you to experience. I also encourage you to listen to him on other podcasts, as his story is so compelling. I hope you enjoy learning about Daniel's journey of self-discovery and how his passion for cycling continues to shape his outlook on life. So Daniel, welcome to the show.
Super happy to be here. Yeah, it's an honor to be speaking with you.
Yeah, this is super cool. I really enjoyed getting to learn about you and your spirit. And I must say that, I listened to several podcasts that you were on as well, and your positivity and just charisma can be felt through audio. So that is a gift.
Oh, I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, and the feeling's mutual too. You know, we were just speaking before we started recording. I was looking for a podcast about how to age gracefully, and that's why I came across your podcast.
Well, we're on a journey, right? Hopefully, it's funny you said you're a physical therapist, and I've taken it upon myself to work on things outside of cycling, because I think cyclists can get very focused on only riding their bike, and I've discovered some very interesting imbalances and issues that I'm very encouraged that are going to help me age gracefully.
Love to hear that. Yeah, love to hear that. And you know, it's a blessing working in a physical therapy clinic, because I see people who do take care of themselves. And you know, there was a patient a couple of days ago who's 95 years old, who's just stayed active, and he's still doing free weight squats with perfect form, and he has just such a youthful energy and motivation and drive for life. And that's the goal right there, you know?
Yeah, you just said motivational youth energy and drive for life, and it seems like you have that. And something that I've heard through a lot of the things that you've said is that you have a spirit of curiosity and exploration. So when did you realize that you had that spirit, or have you always known that you've had that spirit?
I appreciate you saying that. Yeah, I think it's always been there as a kid. I mean, I remember I pretty much grew up in the forest. I mean, anytime I had some free time, my parents would just say, go in the forest. And that's from a very young age, I had the opportunity to start really exploring that curiosity and climbing trees and using my imagination and being active. I mean, using my body, is that's where I feel most at home, is just moving. And I think we're meant to move as human beings, you know. And as we get older, it seems like for whatever reason, you know, society claims that, oh, you can't do that, you're too old for that. But I really don't believe that. I believe that we need to continue moving and continue exploring that curiosity, because that's what keeps you engaged in life.
Yeah. And then, you know, someone might have curiosity and interest and want to explore something, but they might not have the belief in their ability to go after that thing or to actually take action on it. So have you taken action on that curiosity over the years, and what has given you the courage to do so?
Yeah. So the first thing is I look around at people I know. I mean, I remember being 25 years old and I was in Amsterdam, and I met this girl who was riding her bicycle across Europe alone. And busking for money, playing music for money. That's how she was funding her trip. And I went up to her afterwards. I'm like, so wait, where did you start? And she's like, I started in Turkey. And we were all the way in the Netherlands, you know, Northern Europe. And I said, wait, you can just ride your bike across Europe? And she said, so simple. She said, yeah, just go and do it. And it was meeting people like her who totally changed my perspective at life, to where she wasn't some elite athlete, right? She just believed in what she was doing, right? And took it day by day. And I think that sometimes, I know myself, sometimes I struggle with self-doubt, and I may think, oh, I won't be any good at that, but I haven't even tried it yet, right? And I think it's important to turn off that part of the brain that says no, and instead like really believe, like, I may not be there right now as far as my goal, but that doesn't mean that I can't get there eventually.
I love that. I think that a lot of times people are afraid of failing or something bad happening, so they don't even try. And they make up all those stories as to why they can't do it. And then they never do it. And then they always wish that they did.
Absolutely. That's so true. And I know myself, I've done that with certain things. And I look back, and that's something now that really drives me and tries to keep me interested in life. Because my biggest fear, I think, is being, you know, on my deathbed and thinking about all the things I could have done or should have tried at least, right? And so I think about that often. And also just working in physical therapy, I speak to a lot of patients who are older than me, and I ask them, you know, like, what would they change about their life? And a lot of times it's, they talk about they would have used their body more, is something I find really fascinating.
That is interesting. I say for me, one of my biggest fears is just stagnation, and or even like losing the spirit of wanting to explore. Like, what would happen if that got taken away from you?
Yeah, it's pretty scary to think about that. Yeah. And I think if we can remind ourselves just how much of a blessing like each day is, like truly just to be alive on this planet, and especially living in a place like the US where we have so many opportunities. And I try to remind myself that often, because eventually there'll be a time in my life where I may not be able to do these things. So it's important to use your body while you can, and think about how much of a blessing it is to be alive.
So I want to get into your, I'm cheekily saying this, your out and back in the US, just a short out and back. But something you said on another podcast I was listening to is you said that when you're on your bike, you tap into a different spirit. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think what really drives that is just the pedaling, the steady rhythm of just moving the pedals, that stimulates my brain and increases my blood flow, my circulation. And then it makes me way more interested in the world around me. And I think it's a combination of things. I think it's you're getting that oxygen, which is stimulating your brain. And then you're smelling the areas you're going through. You're way more stimulated because you're seeing different parts of the cities that you might not be able to really see when you're in a car. And then also, I think that you're interacting with people, because when you're traveling by bike, I think that sometimes there's this curiosity that people see, and they're wondering, who is this person? What's their story? Kind of like when I met that girl in Amsterdam, you know, and she was biking across Europe. And so, yeah, being on the bike, it just opens up so many possibilities. And honestly, it just drives my imagination, and it fuels the child within me.
I can relate with that. Like, I feel like I'm a different person when I'm on my bike. I'm a more primal version of myself, and I am more myself than I am anywhere else. And I think you're right. I think it has to do with engaging all the senses and being alive, because you're engaging all the senses.
Yeah, I agree with you, Sonia. And also, I would love your opinion on this, because I know that sometimes if I'm struggling just like mentally, if I have, you know, maybe I'm stressed out for a week or I'm anxious or depressed, for me, like exercise is truly medicine. And so when I jump on my bike, it's like it gives me this clarity and it snaps me out of that mindset that I was in for, you know, just constantly thinking about the same thing. And all of a sudden, without even trying to think about it, it seems like often I solve the problem. I'm wondering if you have something similar.
Yeah, I definitely experience more creativity on my bike and a better mood, but sometimes not, honestly, because there can be a lot of pressure you put on yourself. You know, like for me, I'm like training for races. I need to be, you know, feeling a certain way, and that can become not fun anymore. And I've been racing for over 20 years now, and I actually attribute that to being able to take away the evaluative perspective on every single ride, like how well am I doing, and just try to come back into why I'm doing it in the first place.
Yes.
And also doing a different sport sometimes has been a way to just stay mentally fresh. So I just wanted to raise kind of the dark side of the sport that, you know, people might not really think about or talk about.
That's a really great point, especially if you're training for something. I can see how there can be a sense of pressure that you're feeling on it.
I actually wanted to ask you about this. So I was on my ride, of course, when I thought of this. So, you know, in the racing culture, there's this self-comparison thing of like, or even if you're not racing, you're just out. It's like, well, that person's faster than me on the downhill. That person's better than me. That person has more skills. That person's riding farther. In the bike packing, you know, cycle touring world, is there this self-comparison in that way? Or because like I've heard stories where, you know, you guys come up on each other, you like, hey, let's ride together. And in some cultures, people do that as like, you know, recreational riders, but sometimes people are weird and they don't want to talk to you. They don't want to wave back because there's this like fear. So I just wanted to know, what the bike touring world is like.
Yeah. I think that there is a percentage of the bike touring world where as soon as you meet somebody who's on a tour, the first question they ask you, well, how many miles you ride today? How many miles have you been riding in general? You know, so I definitely can see that pressure. And I used to kind of give into that in some ways. And I would start comparing myself and feel self-conscious, because when I ride slow because I'm trying to take in all my surroundings. And sometimes I'll stop in a town and talk to somebody for 2 hours or something. And I remember there have been times for sure where I was thinking, am I not getting the best out of this experience because I'm not like really, really pushing myself to the extreme? You know, and there were certain days when I ride over like bigger mountain passes and stuff, but I definitely can see that pressure from the bike touring community where there is like a sense of comparison.
Yeah. So I'm just raising this also because I think that we forget why we do something in the first place. And this like metric, like how many miles you rode, you know, how fast you are, like all that becomes the metric instead of why you're doing it in the first place.
Yeah.
And I love whenever you say, I stop and I go talk to people and I go see things, because that's like you're doing it for the adventure. I mean, certainly maybe some people are doing it to see how many miles they can ride in a day, but you do miss out on part of the adventure if you're only focused on one thing.
Yeah, totally. I agree with you. I remember my first bike tour, I was trying to get to New York as quick as I could. And this is like 12 years ago or something, you know, and I looked back on the experience and I remember thinking, man, there were so many opportunities. You know, sometimes I'd come across a town that was having like the annual festival in a town of 500 people. And I would, instead of stopping and kind of checking out this small town in Kansas, I would just keep riding. And those are the moments I look back on and think, I wish I could have gone back and just connected with the community in that way. Because for me, in the end, like these travel experiences, it's about the people that I meet and the experience that happened while I'm on the bike, not necessarily all about riding my bike.
So you've done lots of different bike adventures. You've done adventures in Europe. You've done adventures in the US. Have you done adventures in other countries or other like, continents that I'm missing?
So far, it's just been the US and Europe. But my next big bike tour, I want to ride from California down to Argentina. That's the next one I want to do. Yeah, I'm so excited. I've been watching a lot of people on social media. And I'm following this one girl who's like 25. She's doing it by herself from Canada all the way to Argentina. She's unbelievable.
I met a guy, he was riding from Alaska to Argentina and he met a woman on the way. And now that woman is his wife and they live in Argentina.
That's amazing. I love hearing those kind of stories.
So you mentioned curiosity and how people ask you about your bike or about your stuff. I grew up in the US and then I moved to Canada about 10 years ago. And the level of curiosity where people ask you a question out of the blue is really different. In the US, people are way more curious and likely to ask you. So I'm wondering in Europe, are people as curious, are asking you questions about your bike as they are in the US?
Yeah, for sure. In Europe, specifically with my experience, because I rode across Europe last summer. And for example, I was literally just going from town to town and asking like, what's the best roads that I can take, right? And a lot of the times I was going into like, you know, Italian farmland, for example. And like, I'd ride into this town where, you know, these farmers are thinking like, what is this random American guy doing like in our town, you know? So there definitely was a lot of curiosity because I was off like the main bike touring routes. And so that, yeah. And that happened across the whole experience last summer. I was definitely attracting a lot of curiosity from people.
So let's dive into your adventure and your documentary film. We're All in This Together. I highly encourage everybody to watch that. Where can people find it?
Thank you for asking. Yeah. So it's on Amazon Prime. It's on Apple TV and Google Play.
So what inspired you to do this? Because you've done multiple adventures before.
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of years ago, I really started to feel like the tension and division in America. And honestly, it was really bothering me. It was eating me away. I really don't like the fact that it feels like we're so divided. And around that time, I had a friend that gave me a book called The Kindness of Strangers. And it was about a guy who in the mid 1990s, he rode his bike or he hitchhiked from, I think it was from San Francisco all the way across the country to New York City. And he did it without bringing any food or money with him. And the whole book was about just the people that he met and the kindness that he experienced. And after reading that book, I felt so inspired. And I felt like, man, I would love to create something like this, but I think it'd be cool to do it on a bike because I love riding my bike. And, you know, and also the fact that when you're on a bike tour, as I mentioned, you really get a chance to go through the communities and meet the people. And so, and in some ways, you know, Sonia, like it was a way of protesting also, because I wanted to show that we're not nearly as divided as, you know, like news stations and things like that try to make it seem. And I decided to leave with no food or money from California. And I had the goal of getting to New York City. And I really wanted to create a project that showed, you know, kindness, compassion and togetherness. And that was the goal of making this project.
And did you say that you did it without any food or money?
Yeah, so I left without bringing any food or money with me. And I had hidden camera glasses and a sign that said, biking across country, ran out of food, anything helps. And I was standing in front of grocery stores. And if I was fortunate to receive help from somebody, I'd ask them with my camera glasses on, I'd say, do you have a story about when somebody helped you when you really needed it? And I started collecting stories about, you know, hardships that people faced and kindness that they'd experienced in their lives. And the reason I used the camera glasses was because I really wanted to capture like genuine, real moments that I was having with these interactions.
Yeah. And whenever you ask a question like that, the presence that you have to have with somebody, the way that you listen to them, the way that you hold what they're telling you, like that's also challenging. And you were doing that day after day after day.
Yeah, that's a really, you know, that's no one's ever brought that up, you know, Sonia, but it's really interesting that you mentioned it there, because there were certain moments I noticed like people would share very vulnerable moments. I mean, for example, when I was in Illinois, you know, I was speaking to a lady and she gave me some food and I said, thank you. What's your name? And she said, my name's Jean. She said, what's your name? I said, my name's Daniel. And within 1 second, she started to cry and she said, oh, I had a son named Daniel and he just died 6 months ago. And she started sharing this super vulnerable story with me. And it was really amazing to connect with a complete stranger like that and within a couple of seconds. And that was something I didn't expect going into this journey, you know?
And I honestly think that's what people are craving. You know, we're in a huge, pandemic, epidemic, loneliness epidemic. And I think part of that is that we lack the intimacy in relationships that we're craving and everybody is just acquaintances and we want to feel seen and we want to feel known. So what a gift that you gave those people in that moment to feel seen and known, and they were doing the same for you.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And I feel like I received the same as well, especially as, you know, the longer I was on the road, you know, my appearance started to change and I started to get like a long scraggly beard and I was starting to get judged more based on my appearance. And I was receiving a lot less help. And so when somebody would stop and, you know, maybe share a conversation with me, it just started to mean so much more to me. And I was so grateful for that. And I totally agree with you. I think something that's pretty overlooked is the fact that like, it just seems like we aren't gathering as much as we used to. And I think that's such an important part of overall happiness, and to feel a sense of community is so important for our, not just our, you know, mental health, but for everything. It's so incredibly important. And I think that's part of the reason why it seems like, you know, it seems like we're not having those small micro conversations like we used to have when we were in grocery stores or standing in line at the bank. And I think that's really important to continue having those connections with strangers.
I think an underlying current here is it's like humbleness and not being as concerned about shame, because I especially wanted to ask you this because you decided, I'm going to go out on this adventure without food or money. I'm going to basically beg and be resourceful, which we can talk about in a minute. But sitting there with a sign, I'm sure that took an immense amount of humbleness. And did you experience feelings of shame doing that? Or were you just like, oh no, I'm this is fine?
Yeah, Son, you know, what's interesting is I was on the road for 7 months and I covered like 7,000 miles, and there wasn't even after 7 months, I never got accustomed to the uncomfortable feeling of holding a sign and panhandling, you know, and the shame and the guilt that I felt. And, you know, I was fortunate I chose to do this, and I could have stopped at any time, but even then I still felt so much shame about being out there. And, something I also didn't expect was just some of the looks and the things that people would say to me when I was standing out there. I didn't expect to kind of get harassed in that way. And it made me think about people who don't have a choice, you know, who are out there on the streets and how often they experience that. And again, I didn't believe some of the things that people were saying to me, but it really started to have an effect on my mental health. I mean, I started to just feel pretty depressed about it. And again, that's why what was beautiful though is some of the people that I did meet, you know, when I was going through challenging times, the people who showed up into my life, they were so important to me, and they literally changed my life. Because when I was having those rough days, if somebody did show up, you know, it made me think about, oh my gosh, they made me feel so much better. And the cool thing is now I can be that person. You know, that's what I've been thinking about since I've been back home, and it doesn't cost any money. Like, we can be that person to our coworkers, to our neighbors, to someone, you know, at the bank, at the grocery store. We can just be kind to someone. It may not seem like much in the moment, but it can literally change someone's life.
Wow, that's amazing. I also wanted to ask you, you know, a lot of times when people are out and about, they'll see people panhandling and they'll look away or they feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Something that I've been working on is making eye contact and saying, hello, how's your day going? And I feel uncomfortable doing that. And I feel ashamed that I even feel uncomfortable. And then I don't even know, you know, what should I give this person, if anything? Because if they're, you know, just going to spend it on drugs, you know, is that okay to give them money? Or, you know, so like, what is your opinion of that after having lived this experience?
Yeah, well, I'm really happy to hear that you at least try to make eye contact and maybe say hello. I mean, because for me, still to this day, when I walk past someone who's holding a sign, or if I'm at a stoplight and someone's holding a sign, I still feel uncomfortable, even though I did it for 7 months myself. And what I learned from the people was, even if somebody didn't have any food or money to give to me, if someone just kind of smiled or just kind of gave me a head nod and said, have a nice day, like, that really made me feel better. And again, that doesn't cost any money to do that to somebody, you know? And the other thing too is, if you do feel like you want to help in some ways, but you're concerned about, you know, maybe what they're going to spend the money on, what was helpful to me is sometimes somebody would say, hey, I'm going into the store. Like, what do you need? Because sometimes I needed sunscreen, or I needed like some toothpaste, or, you know, so there are certain things that people need that doesn't have to be with food or money. So I think that's something that we could do as well.
Something else I was wondering is the question that you chose to ask people. How did you decide on that question specifically? Because there's so many different things you could have asked.
You know, what's really funny, Sonia, is this, because this whole experience, I hardly had any experience with filmmaking before I left. I really didn't know what I was doing when I left. I just know I wanted to create, you know, some kind of project about compassion and kindness. And when I received the help from the very first person, he gave me a couple of dollars, and I thought, what do I do now? So the first thing that came to mind was, hey man, do you have a story about when somebody helped you and you needed it? It was very casual, but that's kind of the whole evolution of this project. It was kind of going with the flow, you know, and just kind of feeling it out and letting it evolve. And it's kind of interesting. The person who the first person who helped me, he ended up foreshadowing the whole experience for me, because he said, you know, there's a quote that I live by. He said, I don't give because I have a lot. He said, I give because I know what it's like to have absolutely nothing. And what was really fascinating is, as time went on and I started going into different impoverished neighborhoods and things like that, I noticed that the people who struggled the most in their lives, they were usually the people who had the most to give. So it's really interesting how everything kind of just evolved. And I went with my gut feeling. I think that's something that's so important in life, is to really listen to your gut, because I think that speaks truer than anything else.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear about the people in the impoverished neighborhoods are the ones that gave the most, because I think a lot of us, you know, are fortunate and affluent, and we think, well, I don't have anything to give. I can't give anything.
Yeah.
And when you think about people that have way less than you that are so generously giving because of empathy, that's such a powerful and inspiring message.
It really is. Yeah. And, you know, I was so fortunate to meet somebody like on the note you just said. I mean, I met a man named Shorty in Dayton, Ohio, and, you know, he gave me a couple of dollars, and I asked him, oh, do you have a story about when somebody helped you? And he said, well, right now he's like, I'm homeless, I'm jobless, but God got me. He said, sometimes, you know, it's not to our understanding, but there's a bigger plan for your life. He said, ups and downs. He said, keep on smiling, and we got to keep helping each other out. And it was so inspiring meeting someone like that, because kind of to what you just said this guy was literally homeless and jobless, but he still shared a couple of dollars with me. And it made me think about how much I have in my life. And I've always, you know, I had no idea how much I truly have.
Yeah. I think about just, you know, you're changing people's perspective. You've shifted your own perspective through these adventures. I think back to some of the most important races that I've done, and they've been in, you know, developing countries where they don't have garbage pickup and there is no warm shower for you to take. And, you know, you're lucky if you get enough food, like those types of things. And it's a place of privilege to say that, because those are people's lives, like you said earlier, but it also gives you an immense amount of gratitude just for what you have and where you've been born. And like, what do you think people need to do to shift that perspective without having to do something like ride their bike, you know, across the country back and forth, you know, or go to like a race in a developing country?
Yeah. You know, Sonia, I truly believe that some of the best experiences that we, and in life lessons, come from the hardest times in our life. And I really believe that, because I think that sometimes it can give you a level of compassion or understanding that you weren't able to get to without going through that experience. I mean, I think all of us at some point have lost a loved one, you know, and it makes me think about this woman I met in Kansas City, you know, and she flagged me down and was interested in my story as I was going across the country. And I asked her, like, she gave me a place to stay. And I said, why, what made you want to be so kind and give me a place to stay? And she said, you know, I saw you, and it made me think about my husband, and his dream was to bike across America. And he died at 40 years old before he was able to do it. And I'm bringing up that story because, again, I think that if she didn't go through that hardship and that pain and that, you know, in that loss of losing a loved one, then she wouldn't have been able to tap into that kind of compassion and wanted to help somebody. So I think that for me personally, I think that, you know, going through the hard times is where we truly learn the most and can grow and have better understanding of compassion and kindness and hardships.
I'm doing a master's right now in applied positive psychology. So it's the science of well-being. So it's funny, I hear everything and I'm like decoding, like analyzing, you know, the psychological science behind everything. So it's hard for me to hold back. And I think I'm doing okay with that. But what you just said is like post-traumatic growth. And what that is like a trauma happens, and after the trauma, the person is actually at a higher level of functioning and well-being than they were before the trauma actually happened. And it's so interesting that help happens for some people and not for others.
That's really fascinating that you say that. Yeah. And I do think it can go either way, because we can also look at the world in a very angry way after we experience some of these things, especially some really traumatic, you know. And I can speak from personal experiences. I remember after I lost my mother, my mother passed away when I was like in my early 20s. And I remember I worked in a restaurant and I was, you know, I was grieving, and then I just all of a sudden had this desire to start taking the extra food that I had in the restaurant that was being thrown away. I started taking it to homeless people. Right. And I think that in some ways that was a coping mechanism. And I realized that I wouldn't have been doing that if I wasn't hurting. And I think that by going through that pain, it made me want to do something kind for somebody. And in some ways, maybe there was a sense of selfishness in it because it was going to make me feel better. But I think that's totally fine though. If you're doing it for maybe to make yourself feel better, but you're also helping someone at the same time, it, you know, whatever works, I think.
Yeah. I think that pain can turn into purpose.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah.
Well said. I like that phrase.
So you're just talking about food. Like, let's get back to your adventure. Like, tell people where you were getting food.
Yeah. So, before I left, one of the reasons why I felt confident leaving on this journey was because I read a book, by an environmental activist who biked across the country, and he talked about, how he was coming a lot, along a lot of food that was being thrown away in dumpsters. So I thought, okay, that's going to be always an option, right? And once I left, I had no idea how much food was actually being thrown away in dumpsters. I mean, every morning I would stop behind a local grocery store, and I'm talking dumpsters full of food. And I mean like good wow. food, like fresh strawberries, bananas, apples, bagels, yogurt. I came across pasta. I came across steaks a couple times. There was ice cream. It was unbelievable. And sometimes, you know, when I was, because panhandling was uncomfortable, I would just prefer to dumpster dive. And I had no idea that I'd be able to get that much food.
Yeah, I had this guy on my podcast. It was a couple years ago, but he's the executive director of Project Drawdown. And they're a nonprofit organization helping educate people on climate change. And there's all these different sectors. And he said that the number one most problematic thing is food waste. And people just don't even think about that. And I've never thought about how much food might be wasted. Like I'm thinking like restaurants, I'm not even thinking grocery stores.
Yeah, restaurants is a whole nother issue. I mean, I remember working in a restaurant and if someone ordered a steak that was medium and it came out medium well, they would just send it back. You know, in certain restaurants, especially throw it in the garbage. Exactly. Yeah, it's a real shame. And so I was working with an environmental activist, you know, a couple of years ago, and we were researching, you know, food waste in America, and we waste almost 30% of the food that we produce in this country. It's absolutely insane. And in these grocery stores, I mean, some of them weren't even composting the food. You know, if you're going to throw it away, at least compost it.
Yeah, and it's not just the trash it makes, it's the amount of resources that went into creating that food, to transporting the food. Like it's really wild when you think about that.
Exactly. That's a great point that we don't think about. Sometimes we just think, okay, here's some blueberries, you know, but where do these blueberries come from? Especially in off seasons, you know, they must have come from a different part of the world and all the resources that have to go into it to get it there.
So you have a lot of resourcefulness because you had to find food, you had to get money. And now let's talk about the sleeping part, because that's another, like I've done some bike packing like on trails, but not, you know, out, you know, on the roads and stuff. So like sleeping on the side of the trail is one thing. But when you're out in cities and out in the open, like where the heck do you sleep?
Yeah. So I was stealth camping a lot of the way, which means kind of just trying to find, you know, areas and public places to sleep. And one thing I always wanted to be aware of was never going onto anybody's property and being respectful, right? But a lot of times I came across baseball fields, and the reason why I chose baseball fields was because there was always a water source there with the hoses, and so I could always cook my dinner. And if it got dark, I could just do a quick rinse off, you know, and clean myself off. And then if it rained, I could get shelter in the dugouts, which was good. And you know, I slept in some pretty strange places though too. I mean, when I was in Northern California, I was and this kind of kept me more engaged in the experience too, was looking for a place to sleep that was unique. And in Northern California, it started to rain one late afternoon, and I was looking for a place, and I came across this hollowed out huge redwood tree that must have been at least 1,000 years old. And I slept in that redwood tree, which was interesting. And there was also, you know, one night in Pennsylvania, I was trying to find a place to sleep, and I came across this old graveyard that was maybe 20 or 30 gravestones, and it was really soft grass, and I slept there, and that was another kind of unique place that I slept.
Yeah, it would be a funny photo collage, like weird places I've slept.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you ever worry about people bothering you while you were sleeping?
Yeah, and sometimes they did. I mean, there was one specific night I was in Paterson, New Jersey, and I was sleeping behind this warehouse, and man, it was absolutely terrifying. I woke up at 3 a.m. to this truck revving its engine and driving towards my tent. And I had no idea what was going on. Yeah, it was terrifying. And I thought I was going to get run over. And I had no idea what was happening. And, you know, going through an experience like that, it made me think about, you know, people who live on the streets and just how traumatic it must be, because that's an experience that they probably have fairly often, is just someone coming up to their tent and they don't know what's going on. And, yeah. And then there was also, you know, certain times people are curious. I'd be in random, you know, rural towns, and someone would see a tent and they'd come up to my tent. And so, yeah, definitely at times there was an adventure aspect to it, but there was also some fear around it as well, because you feel vulnerable when you're sleeping in a tent.
Yeah, for sure. And also, you know, the elements and like, where do you go to the bathroom?
Yeah, definitely. I got good at just finding a place off the road and being comfortable with that. I remember at first I felt like, you know, self-conscious about it. And just like, it's kind of, it's different, you know, not using a toilet. But as time went on, I started to get more accustomed to using the bathroom, you know, behind trees and things like that. And one thing I will say is I grew this new appreciation for just jumping in rivers because, you know, I wasn't staying in campgrounds and things like that. So showers were hard to come by. So whenever I would come across a river, I would just jump in. And it was actually refreshing because sometimes my body would be tired or sore and that cold water would be reinvigorating. And then I would jump back on the bike and continue the day.
I want to shift for a second to talk about meaning and purpose because I'll put my nerd hat on. Like when you live a life of curiosity and interest and exploration, you tend to experience more meaning in life. And the more you do that, the higher your sense of purpose and meaning. So, you know, I heard you say, I think it must have been on a podcast, like you started bikepacking at age 28. So did your sense of meaning and purpose in life change after you became a bikepacker and started experiencing more like novelty and exploration?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. Because of the minimalism about it and the idea that I think before I went on my first bike tour, I felt like I needed just stuff to be relevant, you know, in society. And I was comparing myself and the bike touring, it really, you know, slowed things down and made me realize I don't need all this materialism and I don't need all this consumerism. Mm-hmm. And what the bike touring did for me was it opened up experiences and it opened up connections. And, you know, and one thing I find is really fascinating, Sonia, is, you know, as we get older, the phrase that we don't use too often is that was the first time I ever did that. Right. Mm. As we get older and with bike touring, I find myself saying that way more often. It's like, that was the first time I experienced something like that. Right. And that's something that I love so much about the bike touring is because there's so much unpredictability about it. And because of the unpredictability, I think that it's impossible not to feel more curious and engaged and stimulated.
Wow. I love that. So, simplicity. And then you said connection.
Totally. Totally. So, connection. Yeah.
So like, you know, when you're out there, you're connecting with people in a certain way. You're not like inauthentically playing a role, but you're like playing a certain role. Like you're out there, your identity, your purpose is like, I'm out here riding my bike across the country or, you know, in whatever capacity. So when you come home, like you enter a different role. Now you're like Daniel, the physical therapist, Daniel, the, you know, the friend to everybody. Like how you connect with people, does that change when you get home versus whenever you're out there on your bike?
Well, the blessing about being on these bike tours, it's made me way more interested in people back home and learning how to connect with people back home. Because when I go on these bike tours, I'm by myself, right? And so it's really improved my social skills and also the idea of saying yes to things. Because before I went on these bike tours, I feel like I was a little more kind of closed-minded. And when I'm on the bike tour, I feel like I'm much more willing to explore different opportunities and connections with people. And then since I've come back from those bike tours, I definitely feel way more interested in the people around me in that way.
What are a couple of things that people can just say to someone else if they're trying to spark connection? Because I think that there's like a discomfort for people to ask somebody else a question because they don't want to look dumb or don't want to seem too like nosy or whatever. So like, what are some actionable things people can do?
I think that, you know, finding a common ground as far as where you're from, you know, and that sounds super basic, but I think that because especially if you're on a bike tour, you know, and you have the opportunity because it gives you this chance to really, give you a chance to really open up with yourself, if that makes sense, you know, and talk to them about it. And the other thing too, is I think that one thing that really comes to mind is just asking someone, tell me a story. Because I think everybody, even if you're not on a bike tour, I think everybody has an interesting story in their life, you know? Mm-hmm. And somebody, I remember when I'm on my bike tour, is sometimes people say, tell me about one day on this bike tour, one day that comes to mind. And I think that we could do that with other people is ask them, tell me about one day in your life.
I want to go back to your incredible capacity to sit with discomfort. Because I think this is very unique about you. Number one, the amount of physical discomfort that one has to endure when riding 7,000 miles out and back. Just even if you had everything, like there's still discomfort, and 7,000 miles is 7,000 miles. So there's number one, there's physical. But number two, you have incredible mental capacity, because you're dealing with a lot of uncertainty, and it's mostly uncertainty. There is no known, I mean, you know, kind of the general direction you're going, but you don't know what's going to happen. And then number three is the emotional discomfort. Like, I think that that capacity, like you said, you still felt shame no matter what you did whenever you're sitting there panhandling. Being able to talk to people, you know, and ask for things, like, that's uncomfortable. So how do you do that? How can people do this more in their lives to sit with the physical, mental, and emotional discomfort so that they can move forward and grow from it?
Yeah. So in regards to the physical aspect, I mean, I draw inspiration from the people around me. And specifically, I have a friend who, he was in a very traumatic, car accident. He experienced a traumatic brain injury, and it's taken him, 8 years to relearn how to walk. And he's wow. at year 13 now, and he had to relearn how to do everything, right? From speaking to spelling to all of that stuff. Right. And I think about him often because, just seeing just how it didn't all happen at once. It was 8 years of really small progress, but he stayed consistent with it. And he's often a reminder to me of when I am on these journeys that, you know, to think about him and use him as inspiration and realize that, again, it's a huge blessing to be out there and, take it one day at a time, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The mental aspect of it, I can speak from personal experience and say that, you know, both my parents passed away at a fairly young age, and, to me that it created a sense of recklessness in some ways, but I think recklessness, I mean it in a positive way, because it showed me that I'm not going to be here forever. And it really made me think about, while I'm here, I want to make sure that I use my time, you mm-hmm. know? And so that's something that came out of the mental aspect. And then the emotional, I think it ties back into, my childhood. You know, my mother struggled with addiction. So there was a lot of kind of chaos in my house throughout my childhood, and going through that trauma, and, you know, there was physical and mental, you know, physical and emotional abuse happening in the house. And, once that I got through that, it just made me look at life so much differently. And I think that, again, kind of going to the pain with the purpose, that's kind of helped me with the emotional aspect of things, and gave me a chance to tap into an emotional side that I wasn't able to get to before that.
How much processing do you do? Like, if you're just in your daily life, like, I love thinking about how the things that we experience on the bike and the lessons translate into our daily lives. Like, if you're in a moment during your day and you're encountering a moment of shame or discomfort or whatever it may be, do you think back to the bike, to a bike experience? Like, well, I did that here, so I can do this. Or is it
totally.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, totally, Sonia. That's another great thing that comes with bike touring is you think, if I was able to cross the Great Basin Desert, you know, and keep my cool, like, you know, the fact
literally.
That, like, yeah. And then the fact that, like, you know, cause I work in physical therapy, and I also work in a grocery store, and thinking, like, I think that, if it gets really busy in the grocery store, like, I can handle this stress based on the fact that I was able to keep my cool not just with crossing the desert, also keeping my cool looking for a place to sleep that night, for example, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I think it does. It definitely crosses over.
And so, something that people think about a lot, myself included, is like safety. And like, people have these like world beliefs. Do they believe the world is a safe place or not? And that can vary wildly across people. So, you know, how safe do you think, like, if you had a rate on a scale like 0 to 5, like how safe you were or how safe you felt on this bikepacking trip in the US specifically, like how would you rate that?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I would say 4 out of 5, I felt safe.
Hmm.
That's speaking obviously as a man as well. So there's a lot of mm-hmm. things that come into this, but, I think that, you know, there's that expression, if it bleeds, it leads. So when it comes to the news stories, so like the news stations, you know, they try to find the worst story they can get. So people watch it and they get clicks and they make money out of advertisements. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what we always hear. We always seem to hear the worst of humanity. But I think that once you go out there and you travel, you realize that it's not nearly as bad as people are making it seem. I had, you know, there was a lot of times when I would be speaking to somebody from one town and I would say, I'm going to this next town. They say, oh, you don't want to go there. Be careful going through there. But then I'd go through there and there wouldn't be any issues. So I think that there's this sensationalism as far as how dangerous it is out there. And of course, there are certain places that are dangerous, but it's not nearly as bad as the news media makes it seem.
Did you get into any situations, like, you rated 4 out of 5, but were there any situations where you were like, geez, like, that was kind of sketchy?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, riding through gang neighborhoods in East St. Louis, that was definitely something that was, dangerous for sure. And it made me, but if anything, I'm grateful for going through there because it showed me this part of America I hadn't seen about how truly mm-hmm. dangerous and the crime ridden and drug ridden these places are. And it made me think about, man, how difficult must it be to be growing up here and to get out of this situation? Mm-hmm. Right. And another example is, I mean, I was riding through in Idaho and a guy flagged me down and he was very suspicious about what I was doing, et cetera. And he threatened me and told me that everybody's carrying guns, so I should be careful, you know. But those experiences didn't happen too often, but there were experiences. And there was one more, I mean, or there's a couple more, but I mean, another one comes to mind. I was setting up my tent in kind of a rough town in eastern Kansas, and some guys came up to my tent and they definitely didn't like the fact that I was in their neighborhood. So I just immediately left, you know.
Mm-hmm. Here's a weird question. Feel free not to answer if you don't want to, but like, did you have a gun with you?
No, I didn't have it. No production with me at all. No, nothing like that. I figured I tried to set up my kind of my lifestyle in a way that I would be able to just avoid all of that. So as far as sleeping and stuff, I always tried to avoid everything. And one thing I did have is I kept my bike lock with me in my tent. So I figured if somebody came in, maybe I could swing my bike lock at them or something, you know?
Yeah, I felt weird asking that because like there's all everybody is like, you know, has their opinion on guns. And it's even funnier now because like I moved to Canada and like the gun culture, there is no gun culture here. So it's just so it didn't even occur to me that someone would even do that on a bike touring. But I thought, well, maybe I should just ask.
I've actually been asked that before. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned like as your adventure wore on, like you went to New York. You decided this isn't enough. I'm going to turn around and go back. Like what made you decide to do an out and back?
Yeah, I think that is, again, I thought about just how much of a blessing it is to be physically capable right now in my life. And so that was something that really drove me is I thought, man, I got here. Like what if I, when I look back at this moment and being in New York and then taking a flight home and say, I should have ridden back, you know? And so that's what drove me. And there's also something in my gut feeling was saying, keep going. And again, back to intuition, I think that what I needed to do was I needed to ride back home because that's when all the experiences really started to get difficult. Because again, like my appearance was changing. So I was receiving less help from people. I was getting harassed more. The lifestyle was starting to wear on me. And if I didn't go through those more challenging times towards the end, you know, on the way back from New York City, then I wouldn't have been able to see this level of compassion and kindness from people that I experienced the second half.
Yeah, it also sounds like, you know, the beginning there, on the way out, there was lots of curiosity, but then it became more judgmental because you look different. So people were judging you and they were less curious. Did you still have the same sign and everything on the way back?
Yeah, it was the same sign. And it was really fascinating because, I mean, it was a combination of things. It was my appearance that, you know, growing a long, scraggly beard, but also the energy I was putting out there. When I was riding to New York City, you know, I was feeling strong physically and mentally. So I was more welcoming as a person. But as time went on and the lifestyle was getting more challenging as far as trying to find a safe place to sleep and bathe and food, et cetera, I was putting out a different energy. And us human beings, we absolutely, you know, can feel each other's energy. So even though it was the same sign, et cetera, people could feel it. And I was pushing people away instead of actually welcoming people like in the beginning of it.
That's really interesting because, you know, initially it sounded like what the sign said was a really important factor here, but it really actually sounds like you and the energy that you were putting out there was the important factor.
Totally. Yeah. And you know, sometimes when I look at some of the footage, I realize I was closing up, like not just like emotionally, but literally physically too. It was really fascinating to see like how, what you're going through in life, how it affects your posture. Mm-hmm. And I was really, I look a lot different just like with my stature, you know, physically as time goes on throughout this experience.
Were you aware of that in the moment or is this more like thinking back?
Yo, it's very strange. Yeah, I had absolutely no idea. And it was interesting talking with friends and family when I got back home the first month or so, especially with my uncles. I'm very close with them. And they were saying how different I was in that for that month that I got back home. I think that, again, kind of a result of the environment and the life that I was living, it changed me. And it's very strange because in most cases, I'm very outgoing. Like today, you know, I'm feeling good. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm welcoming and have a positive energy. But after those 7 months, it was really starting to change. And it made me, you know, I'm grateful for it because it made me think about when I do come in contact with someone whose energy doesn't match mine. And I try to be a little more empathetic and try understanding of maybe they're having a really rough day. And it's, you know,
do you think there's anything you could have done like retrospectively to work on that energy? Or is it just like, you're just there's trauma that's like building up from this, from the experience.
Yeah. I did keep a journal with me and I was writing every day about it. And I think honestly, it was the trauma though. I think is what it was, especially at that night sleeping in New York City. And I think that, that really had a lasting effect on me. And again, it makes me think about, if someone is leaving on the street for this long, like what can they do? And I think that, you know, like the guy I mentioned, Shorty, I mean, he turned to God, like that was him. That's what got him through it was faith. And I think that we have to figure out a way of getting through it in a way that's not turning to drugs, you know, or other substances. And I think that it's really tricky. But for me, the journaling, I guess it helped. But I mean, what really helped was just when I would have a connection with somebody, honestly, and I felt kind of at the mercy of other people.
Yeah, it makes you really think about, you know, people that are living on the street and that's their life. And, you know, the type of judgments we might have when we see somebody, not realizing just how costly that is to you know, not know where your food is coming from and not to feel safe and those types of things.
Yeah, because if you think about it, if they're experiencing trauma every night because of sleeping in a dangerous place, it's not realistic for them to have like a really positive, welcoming, you know, kind of energy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was reentry like for you? Because I mean, it was 7 months, right?
Yeah, it was
like
7 months.
That's a very long time and a very different lifestyle than, you know, coming back home. So like, how did you adapt getting back home?
Yeah, it was very strange. When I first got back home, the first month I spent just at my uncle's house, and I hardly left the house at all. And that's unlike me. If anything, I'm always outside, you know, hiking, mm-hmm. cycling, exercising. But all I wanted to do was just stay inside and sleep, really. Mm-hmm. It was a huge adjustment. And again, I was still dealing with the shame. I was feeling shame even when I got back home. I thought I was going to be feeling like the sense of accomplishment, but again, the lifestyle I was living and having the eyes on me all the time, I felt shame. And something kind of strange that happened was I actually, once I did get a new place to live, for the first 6 months, I slept in my closet. Mm-hmm. I didn't sleep in my bed. And I don't know if that was like, it was comforting for some reason because I was sleeping in a tent for so long, but that was definitely different. And I also, something that hasn't left me from that experience, Sonia, is still to this day when I walk around towns, I'm noticing places where I could sleep. And I never did that before going on this bike tour, but I'm still kind of like on the lookout for places to sleep.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you have a sense of accomplishment now with this?
Oh, I feel so grateful for the experience. And definitely, yeah, absolutely. And I look back at that experience and also just, you know, again, going through that and witnessing the compassion and kindness and empathy, because now I have this really special opportunity to where I can be that person for others, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not about giving money, but it's about when my coworkers are feeling off, you know, going up and just checking in with them. And that's something that I didn't think about before going on this journey. And that's probably the thing I learned the most is, like, there's all this, it can feel like there's so much chaos happening in the world, but the one thing that we can actually control is how we treat each other. And
that's like the quote of the entire podcast. Like, the one thing that we can control is how we treat each other, because I think we get stressed or we get tired or whatever. And it's so easy to dismiss other people. It's easy to even dismiss ourselves, like how we treat ourselves. And it takes so much intention and energy. Sometimes, like, yeah, I have like two toddlers, and sometimes I think about, like, I'm so frustrated right now. And I just try to be as kind and patient as possible. And that could be very hard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially, yeah, when you're feeling high levels of stress, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you about the importance of this, like, retroactive processing that you did through creating this film. Cause like there's the experience itself, right? There's like the thing that happened, the going through the thing, the being present in the thing. And then there's afterwards looking back on the thing and then creating a film. Like, it seems like that would do something, you know, to the story or to how you feel about it. I don't know.
Yeah, it was actually, it felt like therapy to me to go back through and put this film together, because it helped me process the whole experience and understanding in a way that I wasn't able to understand, you know, when I first got back. And there was a sense of underwhelming at first when the film came out in the very beginning, because I thought this only scraped the surface to what it could have been. But as time went on, I started to just appreciate the story that I was able to tell with the footage that I had. But it was such a beautiful experience to have all of this footage and these connections with people, because there's literally hundreds of people that I met along the way, and able to put a movie together about it was really special.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the logistics and like all the hours of film and like the, I don't know if this is the right word, but like being being tedious. Like I do not like editing film because it just feels so tedious, and you had to relive everything all over again, which that must have been really interesting.
Yeah, you know, for the majority of the time, I really enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy putting it together the last maybe 15 minutes of the movie because it brought up a lot of like hard memories. But there, mm-hmm. a lot of the time, it was beautiful just going through. And because again, a lot of the film, it's showing compassion and kindness. And so mm-hmm. I had the privilege of just like putting together a movie and just showing like people just doing really kind things. And so it was kind of a reminder of just the kind of, you know, my belief in humanity, you know.
I have one more question for you. It's around, I should have asked it earlier, but I'm sure there was many times that you thought about giving up for a multitude of reasons. Like, how did you not give up, especially on the way back when you were starting to notice like, hey, like I might be feeling a bit depressed or, you know, this is getting really freaking hard.
Yeah. So it goes back to my gut feeling that when I came up with the idea of this film, it was the one thing that I was the most sure of out of anything in my entire life. Like I just knew like this is what I want to do. This is for sure what I want. And I've never had that sense, you know? And so when times would get rough out there on the road, like I really truly believed in what I was doing. And I believed that even if it was a really difficult time, I thought there's a reason for this, you know, like this is mm-hmm. exactly what's supposed to happen. So when beautiful moments of kindness would happen, I thought this is what's supposed to happen. And when things would get really challenging, like when I ran out of the water in the desert, I thought this is what's supposed to happen. And so it was really just believing in not just my gut feeling, but believing in myself. I think that, you know, it's so incredibly important to believe in yourself. And also I think it's so important to have just one, if you can have one person who believes in you, that can be a life changer, you know? And again, like I can't stress this enough. Like we could be that one person who believes in somebody else and then who knows what they can accomplish because they have that one person who believes in them.
Wow, that's so powerful. I get goosebumps. My husband is that person for me, hands down. Oh. Who's that person for you?
Oh, it's my uncle. And it makes me want to tear up just thinking about it too. Oh. Because I remember there was a lot of people who were doubting my idea, you know, and my uncle was the one who was like, go and do this. Absolutely go and do this. And I'm really happy that you have someone in your life who believes in you as well.
Well, where can people find, again, we mentioned it at the beginning, but where can people find the documentary and you've made more than one. So where can people find you and your movies?
Thank you. Yeah. So the one we were just talking about, We Are All in This Together. It's on Amazon Prime, on Apple TV and Google Play. And then, you can see my first film. It was about biking across Europe. It's called Two Wheels to Freedom. And that's on YouTube. Yep. And that's where you can find some of this stuff.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your story, your energy. And I'm personally touched and inspired by it. And it just makes me want to be even kinder and pay attention to people even more than I am and to be braver. So thanks.
Thank you, Sonia. And thank you for putting this podcast out. I've learned a lot on your 3 episodes. So thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to The Sonia Looney Show. We so appreciate your support and listenership as there are many podcasts out there. I also couldn't do this without my team at Palm Tree Pod. Thanks to Anthony and Emily for all of your incredible support. You've been my tailwind through this year. The best way to help this show grow and find others is to share it with your friends. That could be as simple as telling somebody about it or sharing it on social media. We're also always interested to hear who you want to hear on the show. So feel free to pass that on to us, and our team is standing by.